Welcome to this penultimate Employment Law 101. I am Sarah Wilder and this is Adrienne Hardy and we are partners at MPM Legal. And for those of you that don't already know, and if you don't, I don't know how you don't know because we've been banging on about it on LinkedIn for months, but we are an employment law and business immigration boutique law firm. We're based in Henley-on-Thames, which is a very lovely part of the world, particularly at the moment in the spring sunshine. But we have clients all over the country, and also we work internationally with clients as well, with a common theme that they are wanting to do business in the UK. So we set up these Employment Law 101 sessions. We've been doing them for nearly 6 months now, I think, Adrienne. With a view to taking you through in a little coffee break size snapshot every week, part of the employee life cycle. So we've been through recruitment issues, we've gone through all sorts of things that come up when employees are employed, and we are now reaching the end of that life cycle. So today Adrienne and I are going to be talking about dismissal and different ways of doing that, and also we're gonna talk about without prejudice issues as well. So without further ado, Employment Law 101, jazz hands at the ready, let's go. First things first, we're not going to go into great detail about all of the different reasons for dismissal, because actually we've talked about them a lot as we've gone through Employment Law 101, and we've touched on different areas, but it does, I think it is just worthwhile doing a little bit of a recap. So when it comes to dismissal, you have potentially fair reasons for dismissal. And don't forget that if someone has been employed for less than 103 weeks, then they're not entitled to unfair dismissal protection in the UK. Now, that doesn't mean that you should do whatever you like, because there are still inherent risks with things like whistleblowing, and also discrimination is a day one right. But when we're talking here about unfair dismissal, we're talking about people who have been employed for more than 103 weeks. And the reason I say 103 weeks and not 2 years, as those of you who were on mine and Peter's session last week will know, is because actually people always think, oh, it's okay, it's 2 years, we're safe if it's up to 2 years. And that's not true, because the way that the law works is that you have to include statutory notice when you're calculating someone's length of continuous employment. So if you hold 103 weeks in your head and not 2 years, then you're much more likely to not get caught out by that rule. So 5 potentially fair reasons for dismissal. And the reason that they're potentially fair is that you still need to be able to show 2 things, substantive and procedural fairness. But if you have a reason of conduct, so someone has done something naughty, redundancy, so you are making, as Peter and I discussed last week, some kind of a headcount reduction, there's a reduction in need for work of a particular kind. If there's a capability issue, and that could be someone's not performing very well in role, it could also be linked to ill health. Those things can be combined, or actually it might be just one or the other. If there is illegality, so for example, it's not lawful to employ that person because, let's say, they don't have the right to work in the UK, or some other substantial reason. And some other substantial reason is a bit of a catch-all that covers anything that isn't covered by those things that have happened above. But it's not sufficient to simply say, oh, well, it's SOSR, as we employment lawyers and HR professionals tend to call it. You really need to think that through and work out whether it does actually amount to some other substantial reason that gives grounds for dismissal. And that's generally an area on which I would say, if nothing else, have a chat to us, or if you're using another lawyer, which of course is possible, then chat to them. Yeah. Exactly, I was shocked and appalled at the thought. But if you are, have a chat to them about those specific factual circumstances to see whether actually something really is SOSR or not. I advised on one just this week, which was a situation where we had the expiry of a fixed-term contract, but unusually it was going to be a fixed-term contract that had been longer than the magic 103 weeks, and therefore we needed to think about what the fair reason for dismissal was. And in that case, there's case law that says the expiry of a fixed-term contract can amount to some other substantial reason. So those are your five potentially fair reasons. And within that, you've got to have the substantive fairness to make sure that those reasons are actually fair. And then there's another layer on top of that, which is that you've then got to follow an appropriate process. So you have to, it's not enough to, for example, say, right, we found someone who has been walking out of the shop every night with a load of cash in their handbag. So we're going to fire them on the spot. If you haven't gone through a proper process, even if you've got that person absolutely bang to right, chances are you're going to fall down on a procedural unfair dismissal. And that is a very, very frustrating place to be. And it's the sort of place where you will probably shout at your lawyer because you feel very frustrated, and that will make us sad. So for lots of reasons, including our emotional well-being, but possibly more importantly, the fact that you don't want to lose at employment tribunal, it's really, really good to get your process right as well. So I'm not going to go into any more detail than that, because as I said, I think we've covered all of this stuff in separate sessions. So instead, what we wanted to do is have a quick whiz through some top tips, some key points that we see coming up often and sort of sometimes make us want to hold our head in our hands. So we're trying to avoid that holding head in the hands moment and give you guys the top tips to navigate your way through dismissals easily. So Adrienne, I know that you had some thoughts on that initially.
Yeah, so one of the starting point for me, if somebody comes to me, is let's figure out which one of those five reasons is going to apply and keep it simple. Now, I mean, I get employers come to me all the time going, listen, we've got a crap employee. Nobody's really managed his performance. And I'm pretty sure that out of the number of people on the call, there's probably a lot of people nodding their head at this particular moment in time and just say, we don't really want to go through a performance process. Or, you know, if you're, you know, a lot of people just don't want to be that nasty. So they don't want to say to somebody, look, you're crap at your job, we're going to manage your performance. So very often clients will come to us and go, can we make them redundant instead? You know, we can perhaps do that. Now, it's not as simple as that. And tribunals are, well, we all know that they don't operate on the same planet as normal commercial business, which is what I always say to people. But so let's assume that you land before a tribunal, you say to the tribunal, we made this person redundant. And all the evidence points to the fact that in actual fact, it's got nothing to do with redundancy, really. It was a performance chat gone wrong where you decided to be kind. And frankly, it came back and bit you on the bum. And so I suppose my advice to you is don't try and cover it up. Yes, it might be more difficult to have that performance conversation, but unless we can come up with a properly decent way of dressing it up as a redundancy, and it is possible, but you know, it might be a bit contrived, then be brave. So keep it simple, decide on your reason. And you know, just saying we're going to make somebody redundant can bring all manner of other things up. So, you know, what about selection? If that person who's crap at their job is in a pool of other people, then they come back and go, well, why are you picking me? Why aren't you picking other people? Why aren't you running that fair process? So it can actually open a can of worms that you don't even want to go down the route of. And, you know, and tribunals will see through it, as frankly will the employee's lawyer on the other side. And when I say keep it simple, don't go for the temptation of, well, they're really crap and their behavior is bad and they don't like the way they speak to colleagues. And because all of that type of stuff can also fall under the heading of conduct. And so it's a case of pin your colors to the mast at the start. Let's map out a proper process. If you don't want to go down the proper process, then obviously then we can look at ways to circumvent that. And it always comes, frankly, with getting your checkbook out and writing some money. And we'll come on to how we might introduce that later. So that's my first tip on deciding your reason. Sarah, what about performance, you know, processes, just kind of following on from what I've said?
So I'm just going to have a little therapy session now about my general, it's not every situation, but generally I'd say at least 50% of the conversations I have with people about performance management and managing someone out of the business start like this. Got this employee and they're just not performing, and do you know what, and they're a business risk and we just got to get them out. Okay, well that sounds dreadful. What have you told them about that? What do you mean? Well, what about the last, do you have a performance appraisal process? What was the last performance rating? Oh yeah, we gave them a meets all for performance. So
and a pay rise.
Yeah, And this is where, to be honest, having video chats with clients hasn't helped me, because sometimes my face is quite expressive. And one of my clients in one of my in-house roles a few years ago once described me as giving legal advice with a raised eyebrow, because that was exactly the conversation we had. And it ended up with a Roger Moore kind of, oh, okay. So look, when you have a performance issue, you have to talk informally about it, ideally, before you start down a formal PIP process. So if your organisation isn't having those kind of quality conversations with people on a regular basis, then I think from an HR perspective, and I don't want to tell people how to do their jobs, but from an HR perspective, I think there is some work to do there. So my view is that organisations who really get this right, Adrienne, tell me what you think as well, but organisations who really get this right, it's not a shock to people when there's a conversation about performance, because actually every interaction with a line manager or with HR is really high quality, and it involves that kind of discussion around how people are getting on. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, totally.
And so if you get to that stage, the ideal is that you've had a number of conversations in regular one-to-ones. You've talked about where people aren't quite shaping up. You've talked about what you could maybe do to support them. There's a reflection in their appraisal, if you run appraisals, that actually things aren't quite as they should be. They don't have a meets all or exceeds all performance rating. That's always quite helpful in that situation. And the other thing to bear in mind is your if you look back at your capability policy, it probably requires you to do this anyway. So if you don't do it, if you don't do it for the sake of, you know, kind of high quality HR practices, at least do it for the sake of your policies. Because the other thing with tribunals, there are so many things with tribunals, but one of the other things with tribunals is that they get really cross when people have written policies that are published to employees and they don't follow them. That is something that you sort of see steam coming out of tribunal judges' ears when that evidence is presented.
Even if they're not contractual, they still expect you. Yeah. If you've gone to the hassle of having a policy in place, why wouldn't you use it?
So. You've said this is how we as an employer conduct ourselves. And so the tribunal judge, I guess, sometimes they're simple creatures, perhaps, who expect people to do what they say they're going to do.
Yeah.
Don't, by the way, publish me saying that employment judges are tribunal judges.
Just to remind you, this is being recorded and it's openly available on website.
But you know what I mean. There's a bit of irony there, but the simple fact is, it is reasonable to expect an employer to follow the processes that it's published and said that it will follow.
Can I just chip in on that bit there, just from sort of a hint for our HR population and possibly other people? One of the things that we do is we do some manager training. In fact, did some online management training for a bunch of new managers. And as HR, I think one of the things to remember is that a lot of this stuff might be, you know, common parlance for you and you're used to dealing with it. But ultimately, you might have people in your organization who are technical or scientific or, you know, marketing, whatever, and they're very, very good at their core jobs. They're, of course, then promoted into the role of manager and all of a sudden expected to manage. Now, the feedback that I had when I run these management courses is that people actually are pretty scared of having a conversation with an employee and just tend to tut and moan and sigh and grump behind the scenes if somebody's not doing their job properly. Whereas, you know, my advice to them was, don't even wait necessarily until it's a big issue. You know, if there are bits of the job that they're not doing properly, go, right, these are the bits you need to work on. And that way, it's that whole, you know, it shouldn't come as a shock if ultimately several steps down the line, you end up presenting a PIP to them, performance improvement plan, because, you know, they have been taken on the journey with them. So it's encouraging your managers to say, hey, do you know how to have these conversations? Do you know how to approach it? Because, you know, first of all, you never know, having that early conversation might actually put things right so you don't end up further steps down the line. But also you manage the potential for delusion on the part of the underperforming employee.
Yeah, because I think we as humans, we have a natural inclination to assume that we're brilliant. And so, but I do. I mean, I think there's, you know, that then sort of flies in the face of imposter syndrome and everything else, which I think the two can exist at the same time. But I think we all assume we're really good at our job. So, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I actually think training, empowering managers to have these quality conversations is a really, really important part of succeeding with performance management generally. And of course, I should say, and it's a very good point that you made, Adrienne, I should say that, you know, the ideal is that managing someone's performance improves it, because they are, after all, called performance improvement plans. It's just that generally the writing tends to be on the wall when you get to the stage of putting a formal plan in place, because particularly if you've carried out interventions already informally and they haven't worked.
So, either that or we're just super cynical, because it only ever gets to us when it's reached that point where somebody needs to go.
yeah, true. So look, when you actually get to the PIP, you need to be really realistic about it. And that means being realistic about what you're asking someone to achieve in the timescales. It also means making sure that the objectives are SMART. So, and I can never remember what the acronym SMART stands for. So Adrienne, if you can.
Oh no, you put me under pressure. Specific, measurable, something or other, realistic and timely.
Time bound. Yeah. So, and that's the point. Leaving aside the fact that we don't know the acronym, when we're reviewing PIPs, we always look at, okay, is it clear? If I'm reading this as someone who isn't in your business, is it clear to me what that person has got to do? Because I'm a lawyer, so I have a level of understanding of this kind of stuff. And the chances are, if I don't understand, I'm not clear on what they have to do and by when, and whether that is reasonable, then they won't either. So it's really, really important that you get that right. One, in terms of their potential success, and two, because again, looked at cynically, that's your evidence if you come to a capability dismissal and you're having to defend it in a tribunal. Don't immediately set the employee up to fail. Actually do try and help them to succeed. That will stand you in much better stead ultimately. Also think about whether there's any additional needs that come out of this. So support you might give them, training, a buddy to talk to, because it's a bit daunting to talk to your line manager about this all the time. You might not want to bug them. You might want to be well under their radar if you're on a PIP, but you might want someone who you can talk to give you some guidance. Also, just think about, have in the back of your mind, is there anything else going on here? Like if you've got an employee who's historically performed well and their performance has dropped off, is everything okay emotionally? Is everything okay at home? Are they unwell? Because you might actually have another issue there, and it might actually be something that's legally relevant, like a disability, that you're not immediately aware of. So just have that in mind as well. And that's why making that process supportive can be really helpful there. The other thing is, it's not a gallop. So I totally get that business risk can be created by people who aren't performing, and sometimes you need to act quickly. And we're going to come on and talk about how you might be able to achieve that. As Adrienne said, there is a cost involved in doing that. But if you're actually committing to a PIP, it comes back to reasonableness. You know, it's not realistic. If someone spent 6 months not doing very well and not necessarily having the feedback and the support, they're not going to improve in 2 weeks. So, you know, it's a little bit like losing weight and putting weight on. You can't expect to lose weight that you've put on over a year in 3 days. So, you know, I'd have a similar approach to your PIP process. So that's PIP. Supposed to be a gallop, but there's interesting stuff there. What if someone's been naughty, Adrienne? What about that? What about conduct?
Well, if someone's been naughty, I think the first thing to remember is that, in actual fact, as the employer, it's not your job to prove that they've been naughty. This is not a criminal thing. So it's, you know, criminal burden of proof, as we know from watching Line of Duty and all manner of other police dramas on the telly, is that, you know, it's got to be proven beyond reasonable doubt. That's not the case with conduct issues. You've just got to prove that it's more likely than not that they did what you think they did. And, you know, there is a specific test. You have got to have a genuine belief of their wrongdoing. But the most important bit is you've got to have carried out a reasonable investigation. So that's my first thing to remember is, you know, don't necessarily shy away with it. If you've got somebody that that you believe has stolen some money, but you can't prove it, you know, then, you know, do what you can to investigate it. And the whole point of an investigation is to go through that process of finding out what they've done. You know, it's not a case of, right, we've got the belief, we've got that, we have to go through the investigation anyway to tick the box. It's part and parcel of the process that you have to go through. And one of the most important things with conduct issues is check for consistency, because let's face it, we all have our favorites. That's just human nature. And, you know, if two people have done something wrong, but one person's a stellar performer and you do nothing about the conduct issue, but you then discipline somebody else for the same thing, that can open you up to claims for, well, that's not consistent because you don't apply the same values and standards to everybody. And that's before I even start to mention the D word of discrimination, where, you know, we've got a diverse and inclusive workforce, and you've got to just make sure that you treat all people the same. That's not to say that you have to apply the same sanction, but if you're looking at conduct issues, consistency is really important. And I'm also going to come back to the same point that Sarah made in relation to performance. You've got a written policy, use it, go to it first, see what needs to be said, okay? And then we are gathering evidence, because the evidence that you gather in the investigation will be your evidence in the event that you get to the tribunal, if that's where you want to go, depending on the circumstances. I'm not a big fan of going to the tribunal simply because it's going to take 2 years out of your life. But anyway, that's just my view. One of the key things as well is make sure you split your personnel properly. I'm sure most of you will know this already, so hopefully I'm not telling you something you don't know. But the person carrying out the investigation has got to be separate from the person who ultimately then carries out the disciplinary, because there needs to be essentially like that, the fresh eyes on it, because you don't want any bias or prejudice. I mean, there's loads of things that I could say about conduct. You know, the other things that you might want to look at is have a look in your policy to see what you list out as misconduct, see what you list out as gross misconduct, because whilst it's not the be all and end all to that, you know, if somebody's done something that isn't set out in your policy, it sure as hell helps, because then you can go back and say, as per our disciplinary policy, this comes under the heading of, you know, whatever, aggressive behavior, bullying, harassment, etc. That's all I'm going to say about conduct, because otherwise everyone's coffee cups are going to be empty and we won't have moved on. So do you just want to say a couple of things about sickness, absence, ill health?
Yeah, absolutely. So evidence, I know we're lawyers and we're obsessed with evidence, but evidence. When you are making a decision about capability, about someone's capability to continue in their job, it's absolutely vital that you have proper medical evidence. And that means realistically that you get occupational health involved at an early stage. It's possible that you'll have evidence from the employee themselves. There'll be fit notes if they're off sick, etc., etc. There might be consultants' reports, but again, my rather cynical view is that is information that's been provided, and it may well be accurate, but I don't tend to like to rely on something that an employee has produced alone. I want to get a second opinion on that. And that may mean, when I talk about occupational health, if it is a situation where someone has a condition that's bad enough that it may ultimately lead to the end of their employment, that probably means an occupational health physician, rather than your standard kind of OH referral procedure. So you just need to think about the kind of evidence you need. It can be sufficient to have a doctor's report, it can be sufficient to have a consultant's report, but sometimes it's just nice to have a second opinion. So, you know, that's something to think about. And I think on that, I would say, if you're in that situation, again, that's a good time to pick up the phone, because those situations can be really, really tricky. Mm. So, you know, I think on those, you'd want to get into the specifics. One of the things that I find really astonishing, and it happens really often, and it's very easy for me in my ivory tower to say this, by the way, I totally get that, but it's the fact that contact is sometimes really sporadic and sometimes non-existent. You know, if someone's ill, of course they don't want to be bugged day to day with work-related matters, but actually just the humanity of staying in touch with someone, telling them when you're going to be in touch, making sure that you stick to that, that's really important. And you know, things like that really matter to people as individuals, so it's really, really important to stay in touch. I know that sometimes employees can make that difficult. Sometimes the situation is becomes entrenched or negative, but if you can start off from a position of managing expectation about contact, but then sticking to what you've agreed, I think that's a really, really good basis. In terms of putting, in terms of sort of something to think about is what you're going to do about the role. So if you've got someone off long-term sick, what do you do about that? Can you put someone else into that role? And again, situation, you need to kind of really look at each situation on its own merits. Generally, if you're putting someone else into that role, it will likely be on a temporary basis. So it will likely be like a fixed term or a secondment or something like that. I tend to get a bit more windy, Adrian, I don't know about you, about kind of putting someone in on a more permanent basis, because it sort of suggests that you've decided that person's not coming back when we haven't necessarily had the evidence and the time, the, you know, enough time has elapsed to make that decision. What do you think?
I think it depends very much on the medical evidence, which is why it's so important. If you've got an OH report which says, you know, can't see that the employee's going to be fit for 3 months, come back to me then. And, you know, and then you get a repeat of the same thing, then I'm probably a bit more happy to take a risk, to be honest, and say, well, you know, the business needs to continue running. You might have evidence to say that you can't actually recruit somebody on a fixed term basis, or you haven't got enough personnel that can act up into the role. So I'd probably take a bit of a chance and say, right, go ahead and recruit. And if this person is ready to come back to work, then we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, recognizing, and again, this is the balance of the risk, recognizing that there may not necessarily be either the same role or any role for them on their return. But, you know, if you've got somebody who's been out of the business for quite some long time and occupational health supports that, then I don't think that would be an unreasonable decision to take.
No, agreed.
I'm just going to cut across this because I'm really aware of the time. And I know that people want to know about what we think about P&O. Now, we've got to be really careful that we don't say anything that might be slanderous and get us into all manner of trouble, a bit like Sarah's comments in relation to the tribunal. So shall we just cover this off, because this comes under the heading of dismissal by reason of redundancy, or does it? So, I mean, when I certainly read the news, I mean, look, let's just set aside the legalities, because I'm sure all of you have read the news recently about where the ships are registered, you know, what the law says. You know, there's sort of like a lot of doubt has been cast on how, what the scale is of the potential wrongdoing. So, but aside from the legality, I think we can probably all agree that it's a PR disaster.
Yeah.
And this is something, what can we learn from that as HR people? Well, this is where the communications with the staff are absolutely critical, because not only is it going to potentially impact your business, but you've got to think about the morale of those that are left behind, i.e. still working for you, who might be looking over their shoulders to say, you know, if they can do that to them, am I next? But in terms of sort of like some of the legal issues, let's just break it down into broadly two categories, I think. So let's look at the individual employees to start with. I mean, look, I don't know whether any of you saw my post on LinkedIn, but when it first came out, my first reaction was, I wonder what contracts they're on. So, you know, who are they employed by? Where's the company based? Do they have special rights of seafarers? And, you know, I think Sarah and I have been chewing this over going, what are the rights of seafarers? They're certainly a different category. So, you know, that for us legally was where we started off. But obviously, you know, they're going to have unfair dismissal rights. We've read in the press that they've been offered settlement agreements, and, you know, and we'll come on to that in a minute. But that is a tried and tested way of buying employees out of their employment rights, because ultimately, even if the employees do end up going to the employment tribunal, and it would, you know, it's going to be an unfair dismissal, no doubt. But there's lots of other factors to bear in mind. So in this country, the compensation sort of regime is never to penalise. I mean, you hear about it in the US where there's punitive damages, but that's not how it operates in the UK in most circumstances. So
except
compensation,
this one.
Except this one,
potentially.
But there are potentials, but it's not big dollar signs, is it? It's not big pound signs, because most compensation is based on loss of earnings. And an employee is under a duty to mitigate, i.e. go find another job. So you know, sometimes we have these conversations with our client employer clients and say, look, even if we decide we're not going to follow a fair process, we know that the market for their job is buoyant. They can go and walk into another job tomorrow. So, you know, we offer them 3 months on top of their notice. They should easily be able to get another job within that time frame, which doesn't make it economically viable for them to go to tribunal. So coming back to that then, Sarah, what about the punitive part of this then?
Well, again, we don't know which laws these people operate. These employees were employed under, and so we're only looking at this from a UK perspective. But Peter and I went into this in a bit of detail last week. So if you want to catch up on that session and you haven't seen it already, Spotify or our website, depending on whether you want to see our faces or not. But in essence, one of the only areas in employment law where you have punitive damages is if you fail to inform and consult properly in a collective consultation situation. Now, there were 800 employees here, so they were absolutely like miles over the threshold of 100 employees, which requires 45 days consultation. So what a tribunal would do if these people were UK based, and assuming there weren't, you know, there's all sorts of potential defences, you know, that P&O might be looking at, et cetera, but assuming this is as black and white as some of the presses have suggested, and that these people were UK based, then you would be looking at the tribunal saying, well, you didn't carry out any information and consultation whatsoever, which means that every employee is entitled to 3 months uncapped pay, because the tribunal takes a punitive approach in this situation and says, if you haven't done anything, we start at the top. And they start at the top and work down. And I don't think, based on the facts that we've seen, if this was a UK situation, I don't think there'd be very much working down.
Came the as a other surprise thing, to the unions, didn't it? So it doesn't sound like they started any consultation. So an example of where the 90 days might get chipped down is where, you know, at least there was some attempt to set up that the employee representatives all speak to the unions as required under any collective agreement.
Yeah. The other thing that I think I would be concerned about in this situation is the fact that there's an obligation to inform the government in a UK situation if you've got collective redundancies. And that's all to do with making sure that the Department of Work and Pensions, as it was called, may still be called, is aware of what's going on, so that they can have their right systems in place for supporting people if they're out of work and you know, job centres, etc. And if you don't do that, if you don't submit your form HR1, as Peter and I discussed last week, that's a criminal offence and an unlimited fine. So that would be something that was on my mind. But I you mentioned PR, and I'm conscious we're going over time now, so we'll zip over this and then quickly zip over my favourite topic about off the record conversations. But I think my closing point on PR is, you know, this is an absolute PR disaster, and whatever they were intending to achieve, I think that unfortunately they've really shot themselves in the foot, because I think it's going to have a really lasting impact potentially on whether people are prepared to use that particular company. And I know from my experiences as an in-house lawyer, when the companies that I work for were planning collective redundancies, there was a massive piece of work with the internal PR and comms team to have reactive questions, proactive statements, you know, making sure we knew who the press were going to contact, directing everyone towards them. So, you know, there is a massive piece of work here from a PR perspective. And unfortunately here, it's not gone very well at all.
I've just got one other thing to chuck in, actually, is and this is something to bear in mind if ever you're doing a similar collective process. I mean, obviously we're very much sort of reacting to what's in the press, so who knows which bits are true, etc. But if the job still exists, there isn't a redundancy situation in my view. So in essence, if you're in a similar position where you just go, actually, we're not going to do that, we're going to outsource it. So if they've outsourced it to an agency, for example, and they're providing it to agency workers, in my book, that then raises the spectre of Chupi. Ah, someone's just commented. I think I just about said it just before that comment was made. So in that situation, you know, it's like, okay, as far as you're concerned as the employer, you don't want to employ the staff anymore, so you might think redundancy. But in actual fact, if you still require that job function, it's just you're going to get a third party to do it for you. And you know, I hadn't ever thought that ship's crews would be in that situation. It's normally things like IT teams, it might be finance functions, it might be cleaners, security guards, those types of things. Then the employees would have the right to transfer to the new employer. And so I did wonder whether or not they could all just rock up for work and claim to be employed by the agency. But that's just me supposing.
Well, we'll see, right?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Exactly.
So look, we're very tight on time. It's going to be a very long cup of coffee. But just for those of you who can stay, I'm just going to finish, or Adrian and I are just going to finish talking about quickly about settlement conversations. So a couple of things, first of all, be careful. If don't just assume that you can have a without prejudice conversation. So there's two things here. There's a common law without prejudice conversation, and that requires a dispute between the parties. And my view is that dispute has got to be fairly far along in order for that without prejudice protection to buy it. So I'm talking about kind of, if not litigation, then certainly, you know, the early stages, the sort of ACAS pre-conciliation. It's not sufficient in my view that someone's raised a grievance or that you've disciplined them, for example, because that's part of your internal processes. Now, commentators vary on that, but I would always say let's just be a bit cautious about it. The other thing that we've got is the protected conversation under the Employment Rights Act, section 111 big A. You need to be careful with that as well, because if there is the slightest whiff of discrimination in what's going on, that protection won't buy it. So it is there to enable you to have a grown-up conversation with someone. Where I've seen it used most effectively tends to be in a senior situation where there really isn't a discrimination risk. But do bear in mind that when people are backed into a corner and they think they're going to lose their job, particularly if it's a shock, it's amazing what discrimination or whistleblowing allegations can come out of the woodwork. So my first tip on settlement discussions would be, don't assume that you're safe just because you've uttered the words without prejudice or protected conversation. The other thing that Adrian and I were talking about yesterday, and we are both completely aligned on this, is don't just rely on that WP conversation. Like, have a process. And you and I just without exception advise that, don't we, Adrian? You know, have something to fall back on. It might be convoluted. If it's performance, you might not want to go through a performance process. You have to explain to your stakeholders that there's a potential risk that they go for it. But I'd say 99 out of 100 cases that I've advised on, people realise that actually they don't really want to go through a lengthy performance management process. They'd rather take some cash on the table and move on because they can see the writing on the wall. But if you don't have that open process to fall back on, you're potentially going to have a situation where suddenly you've got a potential unfair constructive dismissal claim. And it just ramps up your risk dramatically. And ultimately, it puts you in a really weak negotiating position. So you'll end up paying more money. Yeah. So that's another top tip. Adrian, any other tips to finish off with on WP stuff?
I think just in terms of just coming back on that process, I always start the process. So typically, for instance, it might happen in a redundancy situation. So this is how I'd run it. Instead of just calling somebody in and go, hey, let's have a protected conversation, we're going to make you redundant, I'd make sure that you have the at-risk meeting. So I'd set up the at-risk meeting so you can talk to them about the business reasons. And the reason I do this is twofold. One is, so as Sarah says, you've got a process to fall back on in case they say, I want £1 million to sign a settlement agreement and that's not within your budget. But more importantly, from the human perspective and the employee relations perspective, at the at-risk meeting, you can give an idea of the business reasons as to why this process is being started. Because employees will always immediately start, what's this about? Why me? This is all about me, isn't it? Whereas if you've got that opportunity to sit down with them, go, look, really sorry, your role's at risk, we're doing a restructure, these are all the reasons why, we'll start a consultation process with you and an invite will follow. And then you go, but now let's just talk off the record for a minute because we are prepared to offer you enhanced redundancy. Then do you see how that then helps to manage the expectations of the employee, but it sets you up in a good place going forward? That would always be my way of dealing with it.
And I think, as we have failed to do today with time, I think the final point that I'd leave us on is have a deadline. So have a deadline on your offer so that you don't leave the process running without any kind of, in limbo. And sometimes it's actually worthwhile writing to the employee on an open basis and without mentioning the settlement discussion specifically, just saying, as we've agreed, we're just going to pause on this momentarily so that we can discuss some other matters. Because otherwise what you might end up with is you're having these great WP conversations, but you've forgotten about your open process. And then you end up with a problem in your open process, and potentially that becomes procedurally unfair. So it's always worth just thinking about how those two work in tandem. That's it. That's all, folks.
I think you said at one point, this is, it's not a gallop. I think we probably just have done exactly that. We've properly galloped through an awful lot of stuff. So hopefully
it's helpful.
Yeah.
And we will be back next week for our last in this series of Employment Law 101. I say this series because it's proved incredibly popular. So if there are things you'd like to see us cover in our new series of Employment Law 101, which I suspect will be coming later this year, I feel a bit like Netflix when I say that, but on a slightly lower level, please drop us a line on sarah@npmlegal.co.uk or Adrienne with two N's at npmlegal.co.uk, or your usual contact, and just put in the subject head of Employment Law 101 suggested topics. Yeah. Because we're really, really happy to build another cycle of these around you guys. It's what we do it for. We want to support you. So thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it, and really looking forward to seeing you next week for the last one in series one.
Thanks, everybody.